We're in chapter 23 of 1 Samuel as we continue our study tonight. Chapters 21 through 27 cover about 4 years in the life of David. During this particular period of time, he has several narrow escapes. We're going to see a couple of them described for us in this chapter and then some more in the chapters that follow. When you get to feeling down on yourself and think that it's really tough, difficult, just go back and remind yourself of what it was like to be a David at the time that he was fleeing from Saul, and knowing that he had not done anything that should have led him to be in danger. Nevertheless, he was in danger, and he's got some men that are with him that are helping him out, but he doesn't know when this is all going to come to an end. And so there has to be a degree of frustration that he faces through it all. Beginning with verse 1 tonight in 1 Samuel 23, "Then they told David, saying, Behold, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and are plundering the threshing floors." Now, why is the report of the Philistines fighting reported to David rather than to Saul? Apparently, the people are regarding Saul as the one who's going to be much more effective in battle. You remember the song that has been sung by the women in the past, that David, Saul has killed his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. And so they recognize that the skill of David and his effectiveness is certainly a credit to him, and that's why they would look to him. This place that we call Keilah is located about 8 miles northwest of the city of Jerusalem. You know, when we talk about that part of the world, we're really talking about a relatively small piece of geography. And these places are really not all that far apart. Sometimes we like to think of that place as comparable to our own country, but it's not nearly the size of our country, more like the size of one of our states, perhaps. Why was plundering the threshing floor serious? It'd be kind of like today, people robbing the grocery store. Where are you going to get your groceries? This is where their food supply was. And so they are attacking him at a place that's vulnerable for them. Who spoke to David on this occasion is not informed. We do not know. But apparently some of the leaders of this town looked to David for help in their protection against the attack of the Philistines. Would somebody read verse 2, please?
So David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go and attack these Philistines?" And the Lord said to David, "Go and attack the Philistines and deliver them."
Okay, the first question is, how did David inquire of the Lord? And undoubtedly, he inquired through a prophet. Now, it's probably the prophet Gad. We're not told specifically, but it suggests later on that Abiathar did not join him until actually he reached Keilah. Some people would say, no, he came at this time, and together they went to Keilah. That's a possibility. But in the Bible, when it talks about people praying and God answering their prayer, remember that the function of the prophet was to be a spokesman for God. And so God usually answered the people's prayer through the prophet as he would speak the word of the Lord to them. Why was it important for David to inquire of the Lord? It's important for David for the same reason it's important for us. Anything that we do, it's important for us to know that we're doing it in the will of God. If we do it in the will of God, then we can be assured that our efforts will not be in vain. However, if we do something that God doesn't want us to do, then we're defeated before we even get started. So it's a never wise thing to do what you know God has not asked you to do, or that God does not want you to do. And that was certainly true in this particular case. The Lord did answer David, and this would be a real encouragement to him, knowing that when he attacked the Philistines, that he would be having God's blessings and would be effective in doing so. Would you read verses 3 and 4, please?
"But David's men said to him, Behold, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the ranks of the Philistines? Then David inquired of the Lord once more, and the Lord answered him and said, "Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hand."
All right, were David's men excited about fighting against the Philistines? No, they were afraid. Now, what happens when David inquires the Lord a second time? He gives him reassurance, so he does not object to his asking him again. And we also pray again and again. Did our Lord himself pray more than once for the same thing?
Yes.
Yes, you particularly remember his time in Gethsemane, "Let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done." Now, what is significant about going down to Keilah? This is a geographic area, and so it just simply does not mean he's going south. It means he's just going down. Anytime you're going to Jerusalem, you're going up from almost any direction. But if you're leaving Jerusalem, you're going down, even if you're going in a northerly direction. And here it's just talking about David and his men being at a higher elevation than they would be when they reached Keilah. Would you read verse 5, please?
So David and his men went to Keilah and fought the Philistines, and he led away their livestock and struck them with a great slaughter. Thus David delivered the inhabitants of Keilah.
All right, what was the livestock doing with the Philistines? Probably was there to help them carry away the loot. We're not told, but that would be a practical, logical conclusion to reach. Was it a wise move to destroy the livestock first?
Yes.
This would prepare the way. This would encourage them as they completed the task against the Philistines. Verse 6, please.
Now it came about when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, went to David at Keilah, that he came down with an ephod in his hand.
All right, had Abiathar been with David earlier when he inquired of the Lord? Probably not. At least we're not informed of that. That's why I think that he probably inquired through the prophet Gad. Why would Abiathar come with an ephod in his hand? Okay, and this would indicate that his position with the Lord was what?
He's a priest.
He's a priest. That's exactly right. And he would be of great help, and he would be able to inquire the Lord on their behalf also. How does David escape Saul at this time? I jumped ahead, didn't I? I'm constantly skipping over more than one piece of paper at the time when I do this. Okay, let's read verses 7 through 9.
When it was told Saul that David had come to Keilah, Saul said, "God has delivered him into my hand, for he shut himself in by entering a city with double gates and bars." So Saul summoned all the people of the war to go down to Keilah to besiege David in his tent. Now David knew that Saul was plotting evil against him, so he said to Abiathar, the priest, "Bring the ephod here."
Okay, why was it wrong for Saul to think that God had delivered David into his hand?
He didn't ask God.
That's right. He should have it made pretty clear to him now that God's not helping him. God has rejected him as king. And Samuel had certainly made known his attitude towards Saul and the disappointment he had because he had disobeyed God, particularly when God had given him clear instruction to completely destroy the Amalekites. Was Keilah a fortified city?
Yes.
Which should make it easier to trap David in the city rather than track him down in the Judean wilderness. However, it didn't work out that way. Upon whom does Saul depend to capture David?
His men.
All right, all of his forces. How did David know that Saul was plotting evil against him? You know, you have to read between the lines when you come to a question like this, and it just seems to me that that's pretty apparent that there were sympathizers with David that were yet in Saul's army. I think that many people, maybe out of fear, maybe out of loyalty, maybe other reasons, were still serving Saul, and yet they were not blind to the fact that David had not done anything wrong, and that the Lord had blessed David in military efforts. Did the high priest always wear the ephod? Apparently not, so that's why David told him to bring it with him. Should Saul have been grateful to David for driving the Philistines away? Yes, he should have been. However, his anger against David as lingers on, and that seems to dominate his thinking and the decisions he makes as a result. Would you read verses 10 through 12, please?
And David said, O Lord God of Israel, your servant has heard for certain that Saul is seeking to come to Keilah to destroy the city on my account. When the men of Keilah surrendered me into his hand, will Saul come down just as your servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell your servant. And the Lord said, he will come down. Then David said, will the men of Keilah surrendered me and my men into the hand of Saul? And the Lord said, they will surrender you.
Okay, how do we know that David prayed in the right manner? All right, he got an answer. That's a pretty good sign. And how does he consider his own role in the sight of Christ?
Servant.
As a servant, right. What was the Lord's answer to David's questions?
Yes.
Yes to both questions that he asked. Did David have to ask a second question again to be sure of the answer?
Yes.
Well, he did, right. Was David concerned for the safety of his men?
Yes.
Yes, he was. Why would the men of Keilah surrender David and his men into Saul's hand? All right, and?
We just all happened, or heard maybe what just happened to all the priests there.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Okay, it's Saul's getting to be kind of predictable is what he's going to do when things don't go his way. Then David and his men, about 600, arose and departed from Keilah, and they went wherever they could go. And when it was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, he gave up the pursuit. Now, how does David escape Saul at this time?
By leaving the city, leaving the fortified city.
Sure, he didn't stick around. He left because God told him that the people at Keilah would not protect him, so he knew he needed to get out there. Verse 14, please.
David stayed in the wilderness in the strongholds and remained in the hill country in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand.
All right, the strongholds here would be places of access in the Judean wilderness where a person could find protection. It's a mountainous, hilly region, and it's a place where there are a lot of caves, and there are natural fortresses that would be places where they could hide and maintain relative safety. Why was Saul powerless in finding and taking David?
God didn't want him to find him.
That's right. God was certainly with him. And this is the thing that we need to keep in mind. God is protecting, he's guiding, and he's keeping David informed as David keeps in contact with God, seeking his direction. David became aware that Saul had come out to seek his life while David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. Horesh is about 4 miles southeast of Hebron. Hebron, of course, is south of Jerusalem, so we're in the southern part of the area of Judah. Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David at Horesh and encouraged him in God. Does Jonathan realize that David could use a little encouragement this time?
I'm sure he
does. In what way does Jonathan provide encouragement for David? Jonathan is very much aware of the fact that his father does not have any real reason for wanting to get rid of him. His father's insanely jealous. He recognizes David is really a man after God's own heart. How do we account for the fact that God could not track David down, but Jonathan could? I think that this is another example of what we would call the providence of God. God, in his own unique ways, is enabling us to be where he wants us to be protected and for people to come together when God sees fit that it's good for them to come together. Would you read verse 17, please?
Thus he said to him, do not be afraid, be because the hand of Saul my father will not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. And Saul my father knows that also.
Why did Jonathan tell David not to be afraid? Probably indicating that he had been experiencing some fear, and so he wants to make sure that there's no reason for him to be afraid. What word of assurance did Jonathan give David to take away his fear?
Saul could find him, that he would be by his side.
That's right. Both words would be words of reassurance to him. How did Jonathan know that David would be the next king? I'm not sure that there's anything that we've read so far that would indicate that Jonathan was clued in particularly, except he's certainly reaching a right conclusion. He can observe there's a clear distinction between the kind of a person his father is and the kind of person David is, and the people's appreciation and what it means to really be a king and to have people follow you as the king. I think he just is deducing this in his own reasoning and by what he observes is happening.
Well, they were such close as brothers. Don't you think David could have told them that?
He may have. That's exactly right. He may have.
Yeah.
How would Saul know that David would be king and Jonathan would not be? Does Saul know that he's been rejected as king?
Yes,
and this has been informed to him by Samuel, and he has to be very blind if he cannot see that God is blessing David with many successes, whereas he is having a lot of failures. Did Jonathan live long enough to see the day when he would, which he forecast in this verse? No, he did not. Unfortunately, I suppose, but he didn't. So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan went to his house. Are we informed of the content of this particular covenant? Doesn't tell us. It's, you know, a lot of things that they could have said to each other. They have been in agreement all the way along, and they're encouraging each other, and they're expressing their strong relationship with each other, and they're probably just renewing their love for one another, and their common concern that right prevails. Do David and Jonathan part ways for the final time on this occasion? The answer is yes, as we read on. The Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is David not hiding with us in the strongholds at Horesh on the hill of Hakalah, which is in the south of Jeshimon?" Jeshimon is about 8 miles south of Hebron. "Now then, O king, come down according to all the desire of your soul to do so, and our part shall be to surrender him into the king's hand." So does Saul get a break at this time?
Yes.
David's location's revealed, and Saul is being informed by those who are offering to help him, hand him over. Do the Ziphites give Saul the precise location of David?
Yes,
they surely do, when you locate it to the exact hill where he is. Now, why did the Ziphites inform David of David's, inform Saul rather, of David's location? I'm not sure I heard.
Want to be in good stead with the king.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that's right. They realized that if they had known this, they had not informed the king, that might get them in trouble with the king. And they're not unaware of the fact of what happened at Nob when Saul had killed the many priests there, and the people had done things that he was not informed of until later on. Number four, where is the shameful deed of the Ziphites mentioned in the Psalms? In Psalm 54, one of the things that you'll find interesting, I hope, as a result of studying this portion of the Word, is how many of the Psalms relate to the experiences that we're talking about here in 1 Samuel. And in this particular Psalm, Psalm 54, at the head of many of the Psalms there are superscriptions. And in these superscriptions, sometimes information is given to the musicians as to the instruments that are to be used, as to the tune that is to be used. Other things are given, but sometimes it'll give the historic setting that prompted this particular psalm to be written. And that is certainly the case with Psalm 54. All right, would you read verses 21 through 23, please?
Saul said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, for you have had compassion on me. Go now, make more sure, and investigate and see his place where his haunt is, and who has seen him there, for I am told that he is very cunning. So look and learn about all the hiding places where he hides himself, or return to me in certainty, and I will go with you, and if he is in the land, I will search him out among all the thousands of Judea."
All right, did Saul regard the Ziphites as true patriots? Sounds like he does. How does Saul show respect for the ability of David to avoid being caught? Yes. He's learned by experience so far that he is a difficult person for him to find, so he wants added help to make sure that his efforts are not in vain this time. Then they arose and went to Ziph before Saul. Now David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon in the Arabah in the south of Jeshimon. This territory is south of Jerusalem. It's on the west side of the Dead Sea, but it's in this general region that probably about 15 or 20 miles south of Jerusalem where this is taking place. We don't ordinarily hear too much about what's going on in that particular geographic area. Did David and his men stay in the place where the Ziphites had seen them? No, he did not. Was David aware of Saul's efforts to find and capture him?
Yes,
he was. Would you read verses 26 and 27, please?
Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. David was hurrying to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were surrounding David and his men to seize them. But a messenger came to Saul saying, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid on the land."
All right, how close was Saul in catching David? Very close. This is one of those narrow escapes. They're just on opposite sides of the mountain. How did God protect David when Saul was so close? Yeah, that's exactly right. This is not the first nor this is the last time that God uses an enemy power to accomplish his own purpose in protecting his own people or disciplining his own people. Verses 28 and 29, please.
So Saul returned from pursuing David and went to meet the Philistines. Therefore they called that place a rock of escape. David went up from there and stayed in the stronghold of En-Gedi.
Yeah, En-Gedi. Okay, since Saul left to take care of the Philistines, why did David move to another location?
It's probably a better spot.
It's being shrewd. Just good common sense. That's right. They've already revealed his place of hiding once, so they're going to do it again. He knows that they're watching his every move. And En-Gedi was on the shores of the Dead Sea. If you have a Bible map and you look at the Dead Sea, it's almost halfway down the Dead Sea, on the west side of the Dead Sea, where En-Gedi was located. A lot of caves in this area, and that's probably one of the reasons why he's there, because it's going to be an easier place for him to find hiding and escape from Saul. Well, David now escaped from Saul twice, and he still has a narrow escape that he's going to yet face, and we're going to read about that in this next chapter. Would you read verses 1 and 2 of chapter 24?
Now when Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, saying, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the rock of the wild goats.
All right, what does Saul do when the threat from the Philistines is over?
Return to chasing David.
Right, he's not forgotten his primary concern, that is to get rid of David. What underscores the danger that David is in at this time?
3,000 men.
That's a lot of men searching for one man, isn't it? 3,000? This is five times the number that are with David. Is Saul determined to find David?
Yes.
Yeah, he is determined to find him, and his determination is not in question. What is the location of the rocks of the wild goats?
Somewhere in
India. That's right. This would be... I'm sorry. You had a question?
Is there any significance to the men chosen from all of Israel as opposed to some of the other troops might have been from certain regions or something?
If there is, I don't know what it is. Maybe, but I don't know. This rocks of the wild goats would have been an area close to Engedi, and Engedi was about 35 miles away from Jerusalem. We read verse 3, please.
He came to the sheepfold on the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were sitting in the inner recesses of the cave.
All right, how is to relieve himself sometimes expressed? Went to the bathroom, okay. Or went to the restroom. In the Bible, sometimes it uses the expression, cover the feet. That's just an expression that was used in that day. But we don't necessarily use that. But it's a case of answering nature's call. Is it necessary to assume that all of David's men were in the cave with him?
No,
not necessarily. The men of David said to him, "Behold, this is the day in which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I'm about to give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you.' Then David arose and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly." Very interesting. That indicates how close they actually were to each other. Do we know where the Lord had said that David's enemy would be given into his hand? No, we did not have any record of this. Somebody may have said something like this, but there's no record that we have that we can cite. How was David able to cut off the edge of Saul's robe without Saul knowing about it?
Saul was not in the robe.
That's right. He probably took it off and laid it in one part of the cave while he went to another part of the cave to relieve himself. Why would David cut off a part of Saul's robe?
Evidence that he was very close to him.
That's right. This is going to be proof that David can offer to Saul to know just how close they were together, and Saul did not know it at all. Verses 5 and 6, please, and 7.
It came about after that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. So he said to his men, "Far be it from me, because of the Lord, that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, since he is the Lord's anointed." David persuaded his men with these words and did not allow them to rise up against Saul. And Saul arose, left the cave, and went on his way.
Was David bothered by the action he had taken in cutting off part of Saul's robe?
Yes.
Yes, he was. That gives us an insight into the kind of a fellow he really was. He was tender-hearted, very conscientious. Why did David's conscience bother him?
Because Saul was anointed of God.
That's right. Teaching us a very, very important lesson even in our day. We need to respect people for the office they hold, even if we cannot respect the person himself. And this is being suggested here, I believe. What is suggested with the word persuaded?
That his men wanted to go against Saul.
Yeah, it's not easy for David to keep his men under control in a situation like this, but David is exercising good common sense on this occasion. That's not to say that David never made some mistakes and never had some wrong attitudes. We'll find that later on, but at least at this point, he's to be credited for his wise counsel. Verse 8, please.
Now afterward, David arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, saying, "My lord the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the ground and prostrated himself.
Does David speak respectfully to King Saul?
Yes.
Certainly does. Why did David bow with his face to the ground and prostrate himself?
Show him respect. Humility.
honor to whom honor, respect to whom respect, give people what is due them.
Plus he had some distance.
I'm sorry?
Plus he had some distance between them.
Yeah, okay. Verses 9 through 11.
David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men, saying, 'Behold, David seeks to harm you'? Behold, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord had given you today into my hand in the cave, and some said to kill you, but my eye had pity on you, and I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Now my father, see, indeed see the edge of your robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the edge of your robe and did not kill you, know and perceive that there is no evil or rebellion in my hands, and I have not sinned against you, though you are lying in wait for my life to take it."
Had David ever given Saul any reason to think he wanted to harm him?
No.
No, and he's making that very clear now. Are the words of David a warning to all of us when he asked, "Why do you listen to the words of men?"
Yes.
Yes. Too many times we listen to what people are telling us rather than what the Lord is telling us. Why was it appropriate for David to refer to Saul as my father?
His father-in-law.
Yeah, he certainly was his father-in-law. Was David under the same eternal or external rather pressure as Saul to kill his rival? Yeah, he was. He just didn't give in to that pressure. What visible evidence did David present to Saul to back up what he was saying? Yes. Had Saul missed part of his robe prior to David showing it to him?
Apparently not.
I think we'd have to say it apparently not. May have, but probably didn't. Verse 12.
"May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you."
Who is David willing to let be the judge of the relationship between Saul and himself?
God.
Right. What promise did David make to Saul? "You don't have anything to fear. I'm not going to lay a hand on you. I have no desire to kill you. You just don't have anything to worry about as from my point of view." What request did David make of the Lord? Yes. Is that the Lord's responsibility?
Yes.
Yes. "Vengeance is mine, I'll repay, saith the Lord." Is David excusing Saul of his actions against him?
No.
No, he isn't. All right, verse 13.
"As a proverb of the ancients say, out of the wicked comes forth wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you."
All right, what is this proverb saying?
What you do is
what makes you. How's that?
What you do is what makes you. So even if you've done it, if I strike back at you, I'm just as bad as you are.
Yeah.
Well, wicked means to be good.
Yes. Wicked cannot.
In other words, wicked men do wicked things.
Yes.
And if you do wicked things, that means you're wicked.
Yes.
All right. Is this proverb that David quoted in the Bible?
Let me see.
Yes, we just read it from the Bible. That's just a question to make sure we're all staying alert. I don't know that it's found anywhere else in the Bible, but it certainly is found here. "After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A single flea?" How does David inform Saul of the folly of his pursuit? Yeah. "Since a dead dog cannot bite or harm, did Saul have anything to fear from David?"
No.
No, and that's what he's trying to get Saul to find out, to realize. If a person catches a flea, has he caught anything of significance?
No.
not at all. All right, verse 15.
"The Lord therefore be judged and decide between you and me, and make me see and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand."
All right, is David repeating himself? Yes, he wants to make sure that Saul understands. Did David believe that the Lord would keep him safe from Saul?
Yes.
Sure, he knew he was innocent and that nothing would be gained by Saul pursuing him. Verses 16 and 17.
When David had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" Then Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And he said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have dealt well with me, while I have dealt wickedly with you."
Were the words of David to Saul doing any good?
Yes,
it seems to me that they're getting something done here. He's brought Saul to tears on this occasion. Was Saul surprised to hear David's voice?
Yes.
Sure, particularly when he knew that David knew that Saul was wanting to kill him. In what way does Saul hint that relations between the two of them can be made better?
My son.
Yeah, he acknowledges David as his son. What did Saul mean by saying, "You are more righteous than I"?
I was trying to know you and you didn't take advantage of you.
Real strong contrast between the behavior of the two individuals, is there not?
Yes.
What will further information about the future reveal about Saul's words on this occasion? I didn't quite understand what you said.
His words don't hold water.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear you. Thank you. Yeah, they're short-lived. He means it, perhaps, but he doesn't mean it for very long, certainly. Now, is returning good for evil expected of all Christians?
Yes.
Yeah, Romans 12:21 will give you a verse. Be not overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good.
Mm-hmm.
Who else in the Scriptures spoke the same words that Saul spoke in verse 17? More righteous than I. You remember who said that? Judah said it. To whom did he say it?
His daughter-in-law.
Tamar, his daughter-in-law, right. What should Saul, and that's in Genesis 38:26, by the way, Genesis 38:26. What should Saul and Judah, in both instances, have said instead of "You are more righteous than I"? What should they have really said?
"You were right. I'm wrong. Forgive me."
Yeah, you're right. I'm wicked. Not to put yourself in the category of the righteous. Not at all. Judah was very wrong in committing incest with his daughter-in-law.
Oh, yes.
And Saul is certainly very wrong in wanting to kill David. Verses 18 and 19, please.
"Declare today that you have done good to me, that the Lord delivered me into your hand, and yet you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safely? May the Lord therefore reward you with good in return for what you have done to me this day."
Did Saul realize that the Lord had delivered himself into the hands of David?
Yes.
Does Saul recognize how unusual David's behavior is on this occasion?
Yes.
Does Saul wish David well?
Yes, so far.
So far, okay. Why did Saul acknowledge that David was not his enemy?
Because he could have killed him.
Because he's alive.
Otherwise, I would be cursing.
Yeah. All right, verses 20 and 21, please.
"Now behold, I know that you will surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hand. So now swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, that you will not destroy my name from my father's house."
All right, does Saul acknowledge that David will one day be king?
Yes.
Yes, he does. What convinced Saul that David would be king? I think there's probably more than one answer to this question. Number one, does Saul know that he's been rejected by the Lord?
Yes.
By whom did he learn that?
Samuel.
Samuel, exactly right. And all of his failures in trying to destroy David should be a real eye-opener to him. And he must realize that a man with the character that David had would be the obvious choice of a man to serve as king over the people. Was Saul concerned about the well-being of his family when David became the king?
Yes.
Yes, and did he have a reason to be concerned about that?
Yes.
The norm was that they would wipe out that whole family.
Yes.
So there would be no chance of future claim to the throne.
David likely would not have been that kind of a man, but he couldn't be sure because of the kind of man that he himself was. So Saul is concerned on the basis of what has been a general practice. Verse 22.
David swore to Saul, and Saul ran to his home. But David and his men went up to the stronghold.
Did David trust Saul at this time?
No.
That's why he goes to the stronghold. Did David continue in his outlaw status?
Yep.
Yes. Why would David move to another place of safety? He's had plenty of evidence to know that at this point, I've not seen any indication that Saul is somebody that I can trust. Coming to chapter 25, we're going to learn about the death of Samuel, who was David's truest friend and ally. Verse 1, Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned for him and buried him at his house in Ramah. David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. All right, why is it appropriate to mention the death of Samuel at this time? Yeah, David knew that he was no longer available for him to go to, even if it were possible to reach him. And this would be a real setback for David, because he had no finer friend than Samuel. Samuel was a real supporter of David. Where did all Israel gather to mourn the death of Samuel? Yes, and this is in the territory of Benjamin, up by Gilead, just to the north of Jerusalem. Did Israel realize that they had lost a great man of God?
Yes.
And that's why they gathered to mourn. Does David's move to the wilderness of Paran have anything to do with Samuel's death?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't say so. I don't really think so. Maybe, but I just think it's just giving us a further report on where David is at this time, and as he continues his escape from the danger that Saul presents to him. What question is raised by David going to the wilderness of Paran? He's going pretty far south, and why would he go that far away for protection? Well, as the story unfolds in this chapter, again, I see the providence of God at work in bringing David to this particular territory. It's going to bring him in contact with a couple of individuals that are going to play a very important role in his immediate future as well as his long-reign future.
Also, so far, Saul has found him wherever he's been in that immediate area, so he's going a little farther out.
Yeah, so he kind of strategically moves from place to place, and now he's moving a little distance further. Verses 2 and 3.
Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. And the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite.
Is this Carmel the place where Elijah confronted the prophets of Baal? The answer is no. That was Mount Carmel. That's up toward the north and over by the Mediterranean. And this is south. Carmel is the modern Carmel today. It's between Ziph and Maon. How is the size of Nabal's wealth emphasized? Yeah, and the fact that you mentioned his wealth before you even mentioned his name. In what way was Nabal wealthy? All right, in his flocks and herds, what was Nabal doing at this time?
Shearing the sheep.
What does the name Nabal mean? Anybody know? Means fool. Fool. Yes, fool. Now, why would parents give their son this name? Chances are they didn't. Chances are this is a name that was given to him because of the reputation he had established. You have to wonder what kind of a woman this was that would marry this kind of a man, which may indicate that his character changed after the marriage. I don't know.
And Laura, he was wealthy.
She was intelligent.
So, maybe she picked him.
Maybe it was a business deal.
Yeah.
Couldn't her father have married him? Married her? Like, given her to him?
Given her marriage
as well? It might not have been her choice.
Yeah, these are interesting possibilities that you're mentioning. Is there a striking contrast between Nabal and Abigail?
Yes.
Certainly is. Were the Calebites attached to the tribe of Judah? Yes, they were. Why is the mention of Calebite important? Because this Judah was the most loyal tribe of Israel to David at this time, and the fact that the Calebites were a part of this group is one reason, at least, why David would be relatively safe in this particular territory. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, so David sent 10 men, and David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say, have a long life, peace be with you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we have not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son David." All right. Why does David send 10 of his men to Nabal?
Find out which way.
All right, they're in need of help. They need some provisions. And he's hoping that 10 men will be able to bring back at least sufficient kind of provisions that would be a help to them. Obviously, they need more than what one man could bring back. 10 men would not be enough for as many men as David had, but at least it would be a start. Did the 10 men greet Nabal in a courteous way?
Yes,
just exactly as David had instructed them. Were David's expectations of supplies from Nabal fully justified according to the customs and standards of that time and circumstance?
Yes.
Yes, they were in the same area, and David's men were protecting Nabal's sheep and goats from any marauders that would come and inflict any harm upon them. What is a festive day? What would we call that?
Holiday.
A holiday, right. It's a time when the natural thing would be, this is a time of goodwill. This is a time you're going to be share with other people, be nice to them. Did David leave it up to Nabal to decide how many provisions he would give them?
Yes.
Yes, he did. Verses 9 through 11.
When David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in David's name. Then they awaited. But Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David, and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shears and give it to men whose origin I do not know?"
Does Nabal respond to David in an insulting way?
Yes.
Yes. Does Nabal act as if David were a nobody?
Yes.
Is Nabal more concerned about himself than he is about the well-being of others?
Yes.
Did Nabal see any reason to give anything to David's men?
No.
Was Nabal guilty of breaking the common acts of hospitality?
Yes.
Sure was, all the above. Verses 12 and 13, please.
So David's young men retraced their way and went back, and they came and told him according to all these words. David said to his men, "Each of you gird on his sword." So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went up behind David, while 200 stayed with the baggage.
All right, how did David receive the news the men brought back from Nabal? Obviously, he is angry, and he's ready to do something about this. Why did David leave 200 men behind? To protect what they had and to guard their camp. Verses 14 through 17, please.
But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, "Behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the fields. They were a wall to us both by night and by day, all the time we were with them tending the sheep. Now, therefore, know and consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and against all his household, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him.
All right, what had David and his men done to merit some help from Nabal? All right, that's right. And this was an excellent thing that they had done. Now, why did Nabal's employees speak to Abigail?
I thought maybe she could put some sense to this.
She was intelligent.
Yeah, and he was somebody he didn't want to have to deal with. They did not know what kind of a response they might get from him. They knew it wouldn't be good. Is it likely that Abigail had acted as a peacemaker between her husband and others prior to this occasion?
Yes.
I think that's a real possibility. Why doesn't the young man who spoke to Abigail explain who David is?
Everybody knows who David is.
That's probably right. Very well known in this area. Did the young man who came to Abigail sense that David and his men might retaliate? Yes, indeed. Had good reason to suspect that. What is meant by the expression, such a worthless man?
Good for nothing.
Good for nothing.
Nabal, fool.
Yeah. He lived up to his name, didn't he? Verses 18 and 19.
And Abigail heard and took 200 loaves of bread, and 2 jugs of wine, and 5 sheep already prepared, and 5 measures of roasted grain, and 100 clusters of raisin, and 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. She said to her young men, "Go before me. Behold, I am coming after you." But she did not tell her husband Nabal.
What was Abigail? Was what Abigail provided adequate for 600 men? No, not at all. But at least it would show kindness, and it would be a help with at least some of them. What was included in the provisions Abigail shared? How many of you, if you had a stranger come your way, would it be this well prepared for taking care of them? You know, when I read something like this, I think, obviously, this did not happen in just an hour or two. This happened over a period of time to make all these preparations, and not only to prepare all this, but also to get it transported to go out and to meet David and his men to offer some kind of help to them.
Would it be possible that she maybe had a little more on hand anyway, though, because it was like a harvest time to...
Shearing the sheep?
Yeah.
You're exactly right. It'd be kind of like, I don't hear much about this in these days, but in the first church I ever served was a rural church in Virginia. And when harvest time came, the threshing machines came through and they had all these extra workers. They would spread the table in a big time way. They would
roast a pig and chickens and turkeys and duck, and it was unbelievable.
And they didn't prepare that overnight either.
No, they did not.
They had to get ready in advance. Very good. Did Abigail inform her husband of what she was doing?
No.
Why do you think she didn't?
Because he's a mean man.
A mean man, yeah. He would have interfered for sure, and she knew that. Because she's intelligent, you're right. Okay. Verses 20 through 22.
It came about as she was riding on her donkey and coming down to the hidden parts of the mountain, that behold, David and his men were coming down towards her. So she met them. Now David had said, "Surely in vain have I guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. May God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave as much as one male of any who belong to him."
What may be suggested with the phrase "coming down by the hidden part of the mountain"?
On the other side of the...
I think she intends that she's going to arrive unexpectedly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she wants to make sure that David doesn't have any opportunity to avoid meeting her and her meeting him. Does the word "behold" suggest that this was a surprise meeting?
No.
I think it probably does. I think that she intended it should be that way. What had David determined to do before he met Abigail?
Light them out, all the meal.
Does that sound like David?
Vicious.
We're seeing another side of David, aren't we?
Sure.
Perhaps we're seeing a side of him that is going to help us to understand the dark side that we're going to see later on when he commits a sin of adultery with Bathsheba and the sin of murder with her husband. Why destroy just the men?
Cut off the generation.
And they were the only ones that would be engaged in warfare, so they were the only ones that would present any problem. What is the imprecation in this, imprecation rather, in verse 22? By the way, what is imprecation? You know, there are prayers in the Bible, several in fact, and largely in the Psalms, that are called imprecatory prayers. An imprecatory prayer is a prayer that you pray that something really bad will happen to the other person. And you have to be very careful in praying this kind of a prayer. You don't just express that without good reason. But the whole purpose is not because you really want the person that you're praying to be cursed, but because you want something to happen to that person that will bring them to their senses so they will not do something that they shouldn't do. So we have to be very careful about this. I remember a number of years ago when I was still working with St. Louis Christian College, one of our faculty members came to me before the chapel service began, knowing that we always had sentence prayers in our chapel service. He said, during the sentence prayer period, would you pray an imprecatory prayer? I said, well, I guess I will. But I'll tell you, I had to give a lot of thought to how I worded that prayer so I wouldn't be misunderstood. And I found out afterwards that the reason he wanted me to pray that kind of a prayer is he's going to use that prayer as an illustration in his sermon, because he talked about the different kinds of prayer, including imprecatory prayers. So when we look at this, look at verse 22 again. May God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave as much as one male of anyone who belonged to him. In other words, what's he doing? He's praying that his own men be killed if he does not succeed in killing them. That's pretty strong language. Now, the Lord understands that kind of language, and he knows the heart of the one who prays it. And so anyone that prays that kind of a prayer has to be very, very careful in that kind of a prayer. Did David have a valid reason for wanting to kill all these men? No, he did not. He's reacting. I'll tell you, when a person is really hungry and they're really needy and they expected to get treated graciously and then were not, sometimes it can really trigger some wrong action. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and dismounted from her donkey and fell on her face before David and bowed herself to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "On me alone, my Lord, be the blame. And please, let your maidservant speak to you, and listen to the words of your maidservant. Please, do not let my Lord pay attention to this worthless man, Nabal. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent." Now, does Abigail approach David in a respectable way?
Yes.
Yes, she sure does. And ask for permission to speak. Does Abigail make it clear that others are not like Nabal?
Yes.
Yes, she does. Does Abigail paint an accurate picture of her husband?
Yes.
Indeed. Does Abigail's behavior on this occasion stand in stark contrast to that of her husband?
Yes.
Certainly does. Did Nabal live up to his name?
Yes.
How does Abigail present herself to David?
As a servant.
How does Abigail refer to David? Yes, as my Lord. Verses 26 and 27.
Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hands, now then let your enemies and those who seek evil against my Lord be his name. Now let this gift which your maidservant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who accompany my Lord.
Does Abigail use clear logic to persuade David to accept her gift?
Yes.
She certainly does. She's very tactful in asking for him to accept her gift. She recognizes the gift is not from her, it really comes from God. She's being very careful. Does Abigail believe that she is being used of the Lord to prevent David from shedding blood of innocent people?
Yes.
Yes, she is used of God, and she believes that. Do Abigail's actions of bringing food for David's men verify the sincerity of her words to David?
Yes.
I'm sure they do. Verse 28.
Please forgive the transgressions of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house because of my Lord is fighting the battle of the Lord, and evil will not be found in you all your days.
What does Abigail mean by referring to her own transgression?
Maybe she's doing it against her husband's will.
She has said, blame this on me.
Yes.
Not that she should be blamed, but that's the love she has for her husband. That's the concern she has for goodwill between the men that are working for them and David's men. And so she asks for forgiveness. Does Abigail recognize that David should be a king?
Yes.
Yes. Is the last part of this verse suggesting that David is without sin?
No,
it is not. She's suggesting that David has never precipitated any calamity or misfortune as Saul had done at Nob. What is the point of this verse?
Wake David up to his about the sin.
Yeah. David is the one who's going to be really the blessed person if he behaves properly on this occasion, so he can afford to be gracious on this occasion. Does Abigail recognize that Saul, who should have been fighting the battles of the Lord, was not doing so? Yes, she does. Father in heaven, I thank you for these moments together in study of your word. My, how good we have it today when we consider the life of David, a man that was so good, a man that was so much in danger, a man who so trusted in you, a man from whom we can learn much. Not perfect, made his mistakes, but a man that really believed in you and a man that you chose to recognize who had a heart that was well-pleasing to you. Help us to learn from his experiences. Help us not to be too sure of ourselves. Help us to be concerned when we think we stand, lest we fall. Help us to humble ourselves in your presence. Help us not to fear the enemy, but to trust in you. And God, don't let us fight our enemy the way the enemy fights us. Help us to return good for evil. Help us to love and pray for our enemies. Help us to be good. Help us to set a right example in our own lives. I pray that this portion of your word that we've looked at tonight will stick with us and will come to our minds, particularly in those moments when we need to be reminded of his behavior. Help us to stand firm in the faith amidst danger. Help us never to forsake you. Help us to be surrounded by people like Abigail who give us wise counsel at the time that we need that kind of wise counsel. Bless each one of us now as we part and go our different ways. May we go away determined to remain faithful and to serve you well. I pray in Christ's name. Amen.